Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Windfall Elimination Provision, WEP, and the Government Pension Offset, GPO, have both been around for decades. They reduce or rule out Social Security benefits for some federal retirees. A bill to repeal them has been gaining unprecedented traction, though. For one view of this issue, Federal News Network's Drew Friedman spoke with the staff vice president of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, John Hatton.
Windfall Elimination Provision and the Government Pension Offset were put into law in the late 70s, early 80s as part of a set of Social Security reforms to help, at that time, improve the solvency of the Social Security Trust Funds. We've been opposed to them ever since. Both of those really reduce an individual Social Security benefit based on income they've earned outside the Social Security system. You know, they've paid taxes into Social Security, earned that Social Security, you know, in the case of WEP, and simply because they've gone outside of that system and earned a pension separately, they are penalized. So there has been efforts to repeal these provisions for some time. The biggest obstacle to progress is the cost. Repealing both WEP and GPO is close to $150 billion. And when you have solvency issues, again, with the Social Security Trust Fund, that's been the real impediment. But we've also, NARF and our allies, have been successful convincing members of Congress that this is still a real problem, that it's an unfair provision in the case of both of them. Government pension offset reduces spousal and survivor benefits. And some cases, people have totally losing that survivor benefit. So, you know, for the people affected, it feels like their Social Security benefits are being taken away, the ones that they've rightfully earned. We have more than 300 co-sponsors in the House and more than 50 in the Senate. They've been around for a long time, and we keep on trying to get it repealed.
I really do think it says something to have that much consensus, especially in the House, to have, you know, more than 300 co-sponsors is a really huge deal. And I know there was a hearing just this week on WEP and GPO in the House Ways and Means Committee. Can you talk a little bit about what's led up to that point and what might still be ahead for how this bill might move through Congress?
There was a field hearing in Louisiana the week of Thanksgiving as well. It really focused on those impacted. In that case, they really focused on the police officers and the firefighters and the teachers affected, because it affects state and local government employees in particular states that have similar systems to the older federal system, the civil service retirement system. Those are the people who are affected by WEP and GPO on the federal side. So they've kind of heard from the individuals affected. They're going to take a look at kind of think tank witnesses in this next hearing and kind of take a look at a little bit deeper into the policy justifications for these and what the options may be to reform or repeal them. So it's a good sign that we've had two hearings on this issue. That's not been the case before. Last Congress, a motion to put this repeal bill on the consensus calendar was filed. That forced the House Ways and Means Committee to have a markup on the bill, but they advanced it without recommendation. So they basically said, we don't want this getting a vote, but we're going to take this off the consensus calendar to avoid a floor vote. So we've kind of started this Congress off at a faster pace than where we were at the last Congress. And last Congress, we ended with 305 co-sponsors, and now we're over 310. So the progress has been building over the last two Congresses, I think particularly comparative to where it was, you know, over the previous decade. The two hearings are good news. The next step beyond that would be to try to push for a markup of this bill or some type of bill to address these issues. So the hope is that these two hearings are signaling that the committee is taking this issue more seriously than it has in the past. And, you know, the hope is that these would be a precursor to some additional action on the bill. Now, that's not guaranteed. That's not set. Certainly up for debate and a lot of uncertainty around that. But that's what we're pushing for, is that markup of a bill on this issue.
And do you have any sense of if that was going to happen, if there was going to be further traction, so to speak, on the bill? What would be the timeline for that?
That's hard to say, but you would hope it would be probably by the end of July, just because we're running in an election year. And the closer we get to the election, the less likely it is that something will happen. So the idea would be get that markup, not just to make progress for next Congress, but to also try to make progress to get this bill to the floor after the markup, pass the House, and then kind of start working on the Senate as well. So I think by July would be the hope, but we don't know, and we'll take by the end of the year too if that can happen.
Right. Yeah, I guess we'll just have to see how that all plays out and just see over the next couple of months what sort of developments there are. But John, I also wanted to switch gears here a little bit because there's another topic that's been really front and center of the news for federal employees and the federal workforce. There was a new final rule from the Office of Personnel Management that's trying to, as in their words, uphold civil service protections and merit system principles. You know, we know that this is a response to Schedule F, the executive order from the Trump administration, to try to prevent its resurrection potentially in a future administration. So, John, can you explain how that final rule attempts to accomplish that?
Sure. So the final rule really shores up the regulatory regime supporting the merit-based civil service. There is statutory law that puts in place certain protections, but the problem was Schedule F kind of found a loophole in that statutory law by creating this new accepted service schedule. So this tries to shore up the regulatory regime supporting that as well, kind of fill in the gaps that Schedule F tried to exploit. It does so by saying that civil servants are going to retain the rights they've had in whatever position they were in. So if you were hired in or in a competitive service position, you can't just be moved out of that position and lose those rights. So if somebody wanted to come along with Schedule F again and these regulations were in place and move somebody from that competitive service position into Schedule F, there would be rights to appeal that position, appeal that change in position and say that these individuals still have those rights. Those can't be involuntarily taken away. So it really says, so you can try to move me into Schedule F, but you're not going to take away those rights that protect that merit-based civil service. Provide some other regulatory requirements in terms of creating, different schedules that would impact merit-based system principles. It clarifies that confidential, policymaking positions are non-career political positions. So there is a role in the federal government for people that are making policy, determining policy. Those are political jobs, not the non-career jobs, and trying to shore up what has consistently been the case. So does this prevent any prospect of a Schedule F in the future? No. These regulations can be changed by a future administration, but they would have to go through a notice and comment rulemaking. And so right now, if these are in place, if these are not challenged, and if another administration, before another administration can go ahead and try to change them, they do provide protections to individuals, protections to that merit-based system. So I think it's a really strong and important step in the right direction.
Yeah, I know. And John, I think you make an important point as well that this is one step, and it is a very solid step from the Biden administration in terms of trying to protect some of those workforce principles or merit system principles. But are there other efforts? I know there was a bill on Capitol Hill kind of related to the same thing. Do you think there's other ways if for advocates or those, opposed to Schedule F to try to make something even more permanent happen in the future?
Yes, I think a change in statutory law would certainly shore up this regime even further to prevent, a future administration from coming in and, proposing a new rule to change these regulations and under, basically reversing them. So the Saving Our Civil Service Act, it's a Connally bill, and the House Kaine bill in the Senate is something that NARFA has supported, other groups, good government groups, employee groups, you name it, that support this effort, support that bill as well. That has, there's been efforts to include that in the National Defense Authorization Act via amendments. That has not received bipartisan support as of yet, even if there are people on the Republican side of the aisle that kind of understand the arguments behind and kind of thinks that Schedule F likely goes too far. They haven't been willing to kind of sign on to these bills yet. So, you're not going to get something passed through Congress without bipartisan support, especially with the current makeup of the Congress.
John Hatton is Staff Vice President of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, NARF. Speaking with Federal News Network's Drew Friedman, there's lots more to the interview. Find it in its entirety at federalnewsnetwork.com. Search Your Federal Life.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era, to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.